Chapter 2. He too know? He fought his way against the rain and the gale on all fours, and crawled at last among some sheep huddled close under the lee of a hedge. They ran off in all directions, bleeding in the darkness, and he welcomed the first familiar sound he heard on these shores. It must have been 2 in the morning then. And this is all we know of the manner of his landing, though he did not arrive unattended by any means. Only his grisly company did not begin to come ashore till much later in the day. The doctor gathered the reins, clicked his tongue, we trotted down the hill. Then turning, almost directly, a sharp corner into the high street, we rattled over the stones and were home. Late in the evening, Kennedy, breaking a spell of moodiness that had come over him, returned to the story. Smoking his pipe, he paced the long room from end to end. A reading lamp concentrated all its light upon the papers on his desk, and, sitting by the open window, I saw, after the windless, scorching day, the frigid splendor of a hazy sea lying motionless under the moon. Not a whisper, not a splash, not a stir of the shingle, not a footstep, not a sigh came up from the earth, below never a sign of life, but the scent of climbing jasmine, and Kennedy's voice, speaking behind me, passed through the wide casement, to vanish outside in a chill and sumptuous stillness. The relations of shipwrecks in the olden time tell us of much suffering. Often the castaways were only saved from drowning, to die miserably from starvation on a barren coast. Authors suffered violent death or else slavery, passing through years of precarious existence with people to whom their strangeness was an object of suspicion, dislike or fear. We read about these things, and they are very pitiful. It is indeed hard upon a man to find himself a lost stranger, helpless, incomprehensible, and of a mysterious origin, in some obscure corner of the earth. Yet amongst all the adventurers shipwrecked in all the wild parts of the world there is not one, it seems to me, that ever had to suffer a fate so simply tragic as the man I am speaking of, the most innocent of adventurers cast out by the sea in the bight of this bay, almost within sight from this very window. He did not know the name of his ship. Indeed, in the course of time we discovered he did not even know that ships had names like Christian P.O.P. And when, one day, from the top of the Talfourd Hill, he beheld the sea lying open to his view, his eyes roamed afar, lost in an air of wild surprise, as though he had never seen such a sight before. And probably he had not. As far as I could make out, he had been hustled together with many others on board an emigrant ship lying at the mouth of the Elbe, too bewildered to take note of his surroundings, too weary to see anything, too anxious to care. They were driven below into the tween deck, and battened down from the very start. It was a low timber dwelling he would say with wooden beams overhead, like the houses in his country, but he went into it down a ladder. It was very large, very cold, damp and somber, with places in the manner of wooden boxes, where people had to sleep, one above another, and it kept on rocking all ways at once all the time. He crept into one of these boxes, and laid down there in the clothes in which he had left his home many days before, keeping his bundle and his stick by his side. People groaned, children cried, water dripped, the lights went out, the walls of the place creaked, and everything was being shaken, so that in one's little box one dared not lift one's head. He had lost touch with his only companion, a young man from the same valley, he said, and all the time a great noise of wind went on outside and heavy blows fell boom, boom. An awful sickness overcame him, even to the point of making him neglect his prayers. Besides, one could not tell whether it was morning or evening. It seemed always to be night in that place. Before that he had been traveling a long, long time on the iron track. He looked out of the window, which had a wonderfully clear glass in it, and the trees, the houses, the fields, and the long road seemed to fly round and round about him till his head swam. He gave me to understand, that he had on his passage beheld uncounted multitudes of people, whole nations, all dressed in such clothes as the rich wear. Once he was made to get out of the carriage, and slept through a night on a bench in a house of bricks with his bundle under his head. And once for many hours he had to sit on a floor of flat stones dozing, with his knees up and with his bundle between his feet. There was a roof over him, which seemed made of glass, and was so high, that the tallest mountain pine he had ever seen would have had room to grow under it. Steam machines rolled in at one end, and out at the other. People swarmed more than you can see on a feast day round the miraculous holy image in the yard of the Carmelite convent down in the plains where, before he left his home, he drove his mother in a wooden cart, a pious old woman who wanted to offer prayers and make a vow for his safety. He could not give me an idea of how large, and lofty and full of noise and smoke and gloom, and clang of iron, the place was, but someone had told him it was called Berlin. Then they rang a bell, and another steam machine came in, and again he was taken on and on through a land that wearied his eyes by its flatness without a single bit of a hill to be seen anywhere. One more night he spent shut up in a building like a good stable with a litter of straw on the floor, guarding his bundle amongst a lot of men, of whom not one could understand a single word he said. In the morning they were all led down to the stony shores of an extremely broad muddy river, flowing not between hills, but between houses that seemed immense. There was a steam machine that went on the water, and they all stood upon it packed tight, only now there were with them many women and children who made much noise. A cold rain fell, the wind blew in his face, he was wet through, and his teeth chattered. He and the young man from the same valley took each other by the hand. They thought they were being taken to America straight away, but suddenly the steam machine bumped against the side of a thing like a house on the water. The walls were smooth and black, and there uprose, growing from the roof as it were, bare trees in the shape of crosses, extremely high. That's how it appeared to him then, for he had never seen a ship before. This was the ship that was going to swim all the way to America. Voices shouted, everything swayed. There was a ladder dipping up and down. He went up on his hands and knees in mortal fear of falling into the water below, which made a great splashing. He got separated from his companion, and when he descended into the bottom of that ship his heart seemed to melt suddenly within him. It was then also, as he told me, that he lost contact for good, and all with one of those three men who the summer before had been going about through all the little towns in the foothills of his country. They would arrive on market days driving in a peasant's cart, and would set up an office in an inn or some other Jew's house. There were three of them, of whom one with a long beard looked venerable. And they had red cloth collars round their necks and gold lace on their sleeves like government officials. They sat proudly behind a long table, and in the next room, so that the common people shouldn't hear, they kept a cunning telegraph machine, through which they could talk to the Emperor of America. The fathers hung about the door, but the young men of the mountains would crowd up to the table asking many questions. For there was work to be got all the year round at $3 a day in America, and no military service to do. But the American Kaiser would not take everybody. Oh, no. He himself had a great difficulty in getting accepted, and the venerable man in uniform had to go out of the room several times to work the telegraph on his behalf. The American Kaiser engaged him at last at $3, he being young and strong. However, many able young men backed out, afraid of the great distance. Besides, those only who had some money could be taken. There were some who sold their huts and their land, because it cost a lot of money to get to America. But then, once there, you had $3 a day, and if you were clever you could find places where true gold could be picked up on the ground. His father's house was getting over full. Two of his brothers were married and had children. He promised to send money home from America by post twice a year. His father sold an old cow, a pair of peopled mountain ponies of his own raising, and a cleared plot of fair pasture land on the sunny slope of a pine-clad pass to a Jew innkeeper in order to pay the people of the ship that took men to America to get rich in a short time. He must have been a real adventurer at heart, for how many of the greatest enterprises in the conquest of the earth had for their beginning just such a bargaining away of the paternal cow for the mirage or true gold far away. I have been telling you more or less in my own words what I learned fragmentarily in the course of 2 or 3 years, during which I seldom missed an opportunity of a friendly chat with him. He told me the story of his adventure with many flashes of white teeth and lively glances of black eyes, at first in a sort of anxious baby talk, then, as he acquired the language, with great fluency, but always with that singing, soft, and at the same time vibrating intonation, that instilled a strangely penetrating power into the sound of the most familiar English words, as if they had been the words of an unearthly language. And he always would come to an end, with many emphatic shakes of his head, upon that awful sensation of his heart melting within him directly he set foot on board that ship. Afterwards there seemed to come for him a period of blank ignorance, at any rate as to facts. No doubt he must have been abominably seasick, and abominably unhappy this soft and passionate adventurer, taken thus out of his knowledge, and feeling bitterly as he lay in his emigrant bunk his utter loneliness. For his was a highly sensitive nature. The next thing we know of him for certain is that he had been hiding in Hammond's pig pound by the side of the road to Norton 6 miles, as the crow flies, from the sea. Of these experiences he was unwilling to speak. They seemed to have seared into his soul a somber sort of wonder and indignation. Through the room hours of the countryside, which lasted for a good many days after his arrival, we know that the fishermen of West Colebrook had been disturbed and startled by heavy knocks against the walls of weatherboard cottages, and by a voice crying piercingly strange words in the night. Several of them turned out even, but, no doubt, he had fled in sudden alarm at their rough angry tones hailing each other in the darkness. A sort of frenzy must have helped him up the steep Norton Hill. It was he, no doubt, who early the following morning had been seen lying in a swoon, I should say, on the roadside grass by the Brenzett carrier, who actually got down to have a nearer look, but drew back, intimidated by the perfect immobility, and by something queer in the aspect of that tramp, sleeping so still under the showers. As the day advanced, some children came dashing into school at Norton in such a fright that the schoolmistress went out and spoke indignantly to a horrid-looking man on the road. He edged away, hanging his head, for a few steps, and then suddenly ran off with extraordinary fleetness. The driver of Mr. Bradley's milk cart made no secret of it, that he had lashed with his whip at a hairy sort of gypsy fellow who, jumping up at a turn of the road by the vents, made a snatch at the pony's bridle. And he caught him a good one too, right over the face, he said, that made him drop down in the mud a jolly sight quicker than he had jumped up. But it was a good half a mile before he could stop the pony. Maybe that in his desperate endeavors to get help, and in his need to get in touch with someone, the poor devil had tried to stop the cart. Also, three boys confessed afterwards to throwing stones at a funny tramp, knocking about all wet and muddy, and, it seemed, very drunk, in the narrow deep lane by the Limicones. All this was the talk of three villages for days, but we have Mrs. Finn's, the wife of Smith's wagoner, unimpeachable testimony, that she saw him get over the low wall of Hammond's pig pound and lurch straight at her, babbling aloud in a voice that was enough to make one die of fright. Having the baby with her in a perambulator, Mrs. Finn called out to him to go away, and as he persisted in coming near, she hit him courageously with her umbrella over the head, and, without once looking back, ran like the wind with the perambulator as far as the first house in the village. She stopped then, out of breath, and spoke to old Lewis, hammering there at a heap of stones, and the old chap, taking off his immense black wire goggles, got up on his shaky legs to look where she pointed. Together they followed with their eyes the figure of the man running over a field. They saw him fall down, pick himself up, and run on again, staggering and waving his long arms above his head in the direction of the New Barnes farm. From that moment he is plainly in the toils of his obscure and touching destiny. There is no doubt after this of what happened to him. All is certain now. Mrs. Smith sentenced her or Amy Foster's stolid conviction held against the other's nervous attack that the man meant no harm. Smith's exasperation on his return from Darnford Market at finding the dog barking himself into a fit, the back door locked, his wife in hysterics, and all for an unfortunate dirty tramp, supposed to be even then lurking in his stackyard. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.